welcome to Headspace, the six-part radio series looking at mental health in Ireland. This series was produced and presented by Heather MacLeod and Gerra Cunahan and made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. In this series, we not only explore in an accessible manner five specific areas of mental health, including depression, suicide, schizophrenia, eating disorders and obsessive compulsive disorder, but we then round off the series with a sixth final show on psychologists and alternative therapists. It's one thing to deal professionally with a person suffering from a condition such as anorexia, but what have they learned from their daily struggle with mental disorder? And what is the best practice when dealing with people suffering from mental disorders? We talk to the psychiatrists, the professors, the psychologists, the therapists, the help organisations, and most importantly the patients and survivors, with the aim of providing a fascinating but simple insight into the world of mental disorder. This first show in the series examines depression. We're told that by the year 2020, the major disease in the Western world might well be depression. Around 400,000 people in Ireland suffer from some level of depression, but many hide their depression and never get help. We spoke to Dr. Nangle from St. Patrick's Hospital, and Porrig, a volunteer with Aware who also has depression. Gerry began by asking Dr. Nangle to explain what depression is.
Well, depression is, I mean, all of us at some stage will feel a bit low. You know, we all feel a bit sad, a bit depressed, which is used, bandied about quite often, that term. And, you know, that's quite a normal feeling. It's when you're feeling low for most of the day, every day, over a certain period of time, and usually it's around a two-week time or two-week time frame that they say, that depression is more likely, or that's when you can say somebody is probably experiencing a depression. Along with that, it's often associated with a lack of interest in doing things that people would generally enjoy doing. So those two features, along with other characteristics that they should fulfill, would indicate that people are depressed, such as, for example, a loss of motivation, loss of energy, concentration, inability to make decisions. Often sleep is affected, with people experiencing early morning wakening or interrupted sleep. Appetite can go. People often feel quite worthless, useless, helpless and hopeless. So these are often the feelings that people have. And occasionally people can think, gosh, I just don't want to live. And that's when it becomes very dangerous, when people start to think, God, start thinking about wanting to take their own lives. So when a lot of these criteria that come together, and that people have maybe five to six of these symptoms all coming together over a certain period of time, and it's usually a two-week period, that's when we say that somebody is suffering with a depression. So that's how I characterise it then.
So, Padraig, would you concur with those comments?
Totally concur with that, as it's not the Monday morning having to face the office or wherever your role in life is, or bringing the kids to school or wherever. It's a number of factors which Dr. Nangle has mentioned there. And if I pick out any one thing or another, sleep disturbance would be a huge thing. That's certainly my own experience. Either too much or too little.
Sure.
Not wanting to face the world, not wanting to interact with family or friends. Kind of withdrawal. As you add on all these different symptoms, as it were, you could be going lower and lower, maybe.
Absolutely.
You know, and when you add all those up over,
right,
you know, a period of some weeks, you really need to be talking to your GP for starters, or even before that, maybe there might be one particular member of the family who you particularly relate to, maybe talk to them, or maybe a friend outside the family, and really you should start to getting something done about it.
Yeah.
Does age figure a lot in it? I mean, is there such a thing as a 10-year-old depressed person, or is it normally past a certain age?
Just in terms of bipolar depression, which means you suffer both the highs and the lows in extreme forms. I mean, they say the onset of bipolar disorder, what used to be referred to as manic depression, is something like between 16 and 34 or so, you know. So if somebody comes into your doctor kind of showing some symptoms like as has been described, adding on the various high symptoms, you know, no sleep, huge energy, inappropriate behaviour, all that kind of thing. And
that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, I suppose the big factor here is it can affect anyone at any time and at any age. So there's no specifics with regard to when it can happen. I suppose with regard, I know from talking to my colleagues at St. Patrick's Hospital and one of the child and adolescent psychiatrists, she has treated people with as young as 10 years of age with a clinical depression. So it can affect anyone. You know, there's a number of factors that are involved in becoming or having a depression. And it's, as we said, it's a biological predisposition along with a number of factors that act in some way or form together to trigger it. And it usually is due to a life event or some factor or stressful, you know, thing that's going on in their lives that could trigger it, along with other factors that are there from previous experiences.
Padraig or Dr. Nangle, can you try to explain what it's like to be depressed? What it feels like? We can describe it in a book, but what does it feel like as a human being to be depressed?
You don't want to know. You don't want to know. And I'd repeat that as kind of a modern day way of putting it. You know, what we talked about earlier, you want to be left on your own. You don't want to face your family or your friends or your work. You're withdrawing, you know, and withdrawing into yourself, and you're unable to cope with everyday life. Going back to the reasons for it, I mean, as Dr. Nangle said, you could have an inbuilt disposition towards it, and then life events can kind of come on top of you, that the combination, you end up being depressed or indeed being bipolar, which is both the highs and the lows. There's a very good way, maybe in the Irish language, depression is referred to as an galar dubh or an galar dubh, which means the black illness, and it's very black. And Churchill referred to during the Second World War, referred to the black dog.
Yes, I read that. Yeah, I think Padraig obviously is the best person to, he's experienced it, he's the best able to describe it. But we have heard people also describe it as a black hole or a tunnel that they can't see any light from. So it's just, you know, everything is closing in on the person, and they just feel completely isolated, and nothing else is getting in, and nothing is able to get out.
Even if a good friend might come along and say, "Ah, come on, oh, that cheer up."
Well, that depends, I think, on the degree of the depression. I mean, there's lots of different, there's types and levels and degrees of depression. So you could have mild, moderate, severe. In the mild depression, I mean, 4 out of 5 people generally will come out of it themselves, but it can take up to 6 months for that to happen, you know. But that's still a very difficult period of time to be in that kind of situation. And who knows, I suppose the 1 in 5, it's very hard to predict who that 1 in 5 is going to be, and if it's going to progress on to a moderate or more severe depression.
Dr. Nangle, would you say that there is an increasing number of people presenting with depression at St. Patrick's Hospital?
Well, we certainly noticed more men presenting and young men. Actually, men of all ages are presenting more. That's certainly been observed in the last 12 months coming into St. Patrick's Hospital, not only to the assessment unit, but also to our multidisciplinary community outpatient units. They're called the Dean Clinics, which have been established in the last few years. And we are also seeing research that has been done in St. Patrick's Hospital has shown there's been an 11% increase in self-harm among men in the last 12 months. And we think that's probably related to the economic downturn. So people are presenting a lot more with stress-related depressive symptomatology. So I think we're certainly seeing more people presenting with it, yeah.
You're listening to Headspace on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the series looking at mental health in Ireland. We're still discussing depression. Jerry now touches on gender and depression and also asks Padraig for his story.
And of course, one of the interesting points is that the men are actually taking this step, because it has been traditional to speak about men in terms of illnesses or problems as being the gender that doesn't particularly like to nip something in the bud. They like to let it go on and on and on and leave it to the last moment. That's the cliche about men anyway. Now, Padraig, you are a man. And you suffered. I'm almost afraid to say it because I have to be, you know.
Oh, so suffering is the appropriate right word. For this.
What clinically and what exactly did you suffer from? If you don't mind me asking.
I've been kind of around the block and back, as it were, at this stage. But in 1968, I was a third year honours art student in UCD, and to make a long story short, I became severely ill, which was then diagnosed as bipolar depression. I became, you know, quite psychotic, which means I lost my whole sense of what was going on around me. I didn't know what was going on. I wasn't sleeping. I really genuinely did not know what was happening to me. And even looking back all those years, I can only express horror what happened to me as well. You know, I wasn't sleeping. I didn't know day from night. I was irritable. But I was lucky in the sense that I was admitted to St. Patrick's soon after being seen by a psychiatrist. And I was also lucky, in fact, in that I got a diagnosis, because that's one of the problems with mental health in general, is getting a proper diagnosis, you know. So at least they knew what they were dealing with, and they could understand kind of where I was. So I was treated over the next couple of years. I spent more time in hospital than outside. And eventually I came back out into the world, as it were, back to college, but didn't get my degree. My concentration was awful. I was on a high dose of medication. But I managed to get a job in the civil service, which was a huge plus. Shortly after that, I got married. And about within years, I was severely ill again, 75, spent nearly 5 months in hospital. And they found it very difficult to stabilise me. And out again at the end of 75. And over the next 10 years, it was very difficult. I think I gave an example of, you know, what it means to be depressed. I'd come home from work in the evening, and I'd be lying on the couch. But I wouldn't be lying on the couch watching the telly. I'd be looking inwards. And which is a very good indicator of how bad things were. So 85, again, I ended up for a long time in St. Patrick's. And while I'm saying that, I owe St. Patrick's a huge amount. They cared for me for so much and so understandingly. I do owe them an awful lot. But things always turn around, I suppose, in this life. 87 or so, I was introduced to a medication called lithium. And this stopped my mood swings in their tracks, literally. And it was a remarkable transformation in that I actually became well. Now, at this stage, my marriage was gone, but that was that. But I came back living in Dublin. I was able to live on my own and cope with life, and started to do well in work. And I eventually, in 1995, I was appointed clerk to the Oil Committee, which was a job I held for the next 15 years until I retired last September. So really what I'm saying to you is that no matter how bad it is, it does come around. People can be helped. People can be managed. People can receive appropriate medication, perhaps combined with some talk therapy, attending a support group like AWARE, which I found hugely beneficial. You know,
that's AWARE,
the depression support group. Mm-hmm. And that was fantastic for me, because when I came back to living in Dublin, I mean, I knew nobody. I was kind of a almost unusual person. I was separated, which was not a common thing in those days, 86. And I also had a history of mental illness, but just about hanging on to my job. But a kind of a combination of attending an AWARE support group, which were starting up at the time, plus lithium. And then I have to mention that, to be fair to myself and to all concerned, that in the end of 1993, New Year's Eve, I had my last pint, because really for me, medication, stroke, depression don't work. So I had my last pint. I haven't had one since. That was another great factor. So combining all those three factors, things actually have worked out. And I had a very good career in the Dáil as a clerk to the Dáil Committee, and retired happily last September.
To the outsider, to the ignorant outsider, the well-meaning outsider, could it be said flippantly, sure, drink makes you depressed. It's not as simple as that, Dr. Nangle, is it? Sure, it was the drink.
No, certainly not in Padraig's case. We couldn't be saying that. No, but as we were saying earlier on, alcohol is a depressant and it can skew the picture. So, and I suppose it's a catch-22 situation because sometimes, and we see that quite often in men, that men or people can treat, if they're low in mood, or they can treat their symptomatology using alcohol or another illicit drug or, you know, various agents. And vice versa, if somebody is already predisposed to depression and they drink, then, you know, it's not a good combination. And it can be particularly dangerous in young men, and we're seeing that more and more, where they can be quite impulsive after having a drink and unfortunately can take their own lives. At times, as we were talking about earlier on, when they probably or most likely don't mean to. But the combination of alcohol and low mood and a depression is very dangerous.
And also, I suppose, maybe what people wouldn't maybe realise that alcohol severely affects your sleep.
Yes,
I mean,
that's
you
right.
come home, you know, from the pub, a great night out, and you're a bit dozy. You've had a fish and chips or something, and you roll into bed, and you know you fall asleep. Come 2 o'clock in the morning, you're as bright as a button, and that's the end of the sleep for the night.
That's
and
right.
People can't live this life, whatever way they are, whatever condition they have, or if they have no condition. But if you're not sleeping, you can't cope.
No, and that's one. I suppose that's one important point to make. And Padraig mentioned that earlier on, is that sleep is often an early warning sign of a mood disorder. So interference with sleep or not sleeping properly is often a first warning sign, and it's often something that's seen. And so if you have alcohol and alcohol is interfering with your sleep, of course, when you don't get your sleep, it's going to interfere with the concentration. You're going to be more tired, irritable, and more likely, you know, for your mood to go down also. So it is a very important factor there. And that's where, I suppose, St. Patrick's Hospital, you mentioned, where I work there, and we have a dual diagnosis program. So it deals with people with both addiction problems and also mood disorders. So it caters to that aspect, because we are seeing more and more people presenting not just one, you know, classical depression, but they often may have two or three different diagnoses in the one. And you have to look at the person holistically. And we would like to think, or I'd certainly like to think, I treat somebody from, you know, a biopsychosocial perspective. So you look at all aspects of the person's life and see what you can do to manage it in some appropriate way.
But I'm surprised, and I said it before to you, I'm a little bit surprised that men are presenting at all. I could say, jeepers, I thought men didn't do those things. I thought men did not present themselves.
Don't question it. It's good. It's good. It's good. Yeah. You know, it's good.
You're listening to Headspace on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the series looking at mental health in Ireland, where we're still discussing depression. Dr. Nangle now talks about stigma, depression and change.
Padraig mentioned earlier on, I mean, things have changed dramatically in the last 40 years since it was something that was hidden. There's a huge stigma, or has been a huge stigma around mental illness. Unfortunately, it's still there. However, it is being tackled and tackled appropriately. And I think people, you know, like Padraig are being very helpful. They're talking about it openly. And that makes people feel like, oh, hey, I'm not alone. There's other people out there with that.
Which is what I said when I first attended my first aware support group. There were people like me there. There were people who felt like I did.
Yeah.
There were people who had problems like I had in terms of the illness. There were people who would suggest, why don't you give your doctor a call in the morning? Why don't you go down to your local health centre, see what they think? Nip it in the bud, you know, and you're not unique, you know, and I suppose the whole thing, what Dr. Dangle is saying as well, things have changed a lot. There are huge options available now which weren't there. I mean, when I talk about my own particular case, you're talking about over 40 years ago, you know, there was very little understanding in those days of the problem. Now there are a lot of There's a huge research has been done and all the rest of it. There are options available to people. There's far more talk therapy. There's a far greater range of medications available. Things like mood stabilizers, which are so important to myself as I suffer from bipolar disorder, they weren't being prescribed when I first became ill. You know,
so. And we talk about recovery, etc. Mm. Now, you won't remember every single date and timeline in your journey of suffering, Padraig. But at any stage, was there a reprieve, a moment of relief?
There was, I suppose. But really what I'm talking about is a period of over 40 years. The first 20 years were hell. There may have been occasional, you know, good times and all the rest of it, you know, but, you know, not so good as a climate overall. But when things started to turn around, when I joined Aware, when I was put on lithium, the lithium was hugely significant for me. Yeah. You know, that was major. And then when I stopped my pints, those three things taken together. And then, of course, you develop, you regain your self-esteem and, you know, you feel better about yourself. And I had a very successful career in the civil service in the end of the day. That all helped. That all makes it all bearable. And, you know.
And as a man at the time, was it easy to talk to other men? Or was the group, I'm just trying to think, that first group you went to in Aware, was it, this is a terrible sexist thing to say, was it full of men? Was it full of women? Was it easy to talk?
It was easy to talk. I don't remember straight off, but it was a mixture of men and women. You know, it was kind of a safe environment. Aware support groups are confidential. They're run by trained facilitators who, you know the story, as it were, you know. And it was such a relief on it. I mean, I made friends in Aware, which I still have to this day. And I wouldn't be beyond if, say a particular problem or something, picking up the phone or, how you, listen, I'm feeling this or that. And, you know, or even calling over to friends. I developed a whole network of friends through Aware. You know, it's hugely significant in my life.
Good. And there is life after depression, and Dr. Nangle, is that so?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key, or a lot, there's a lot of different factors there now, but I think having support and having peer support is vitally important. If people know that they're not alone in this and there are other people in similar situations, I think that makes a big difference. It's very easy for, as a professional, you know, just to dole out, you know, and say, this is what you have, this is what you do. But, you know, only other people who've experienced depression are empathic, really. They're the ones who really are in the know. So they're the ones who can, and they're the ones sometimes, particularly in the younger person, you notice, and the younger male, they think, oh yeah, here's someone just saying, oh yeah, right, you're older, take this, yeah, right, I'm not really, you know, I don't really believe it. But if they're with peer support and they're with people of similar age.
Engage, yeah.
Absolutely. So I think that's very important. I mean, I think one of the key tips for managing depression would be to, you know, get to talk to someone, to talk to a family friend, somebody that you know you can rely on. And if, you know, that's not enough, your GP is certainly the first port of call you should go to, or a mental health professional if you have or know one.
Antidepressants have at certain stages attracted negative publicity. Mm-hmm. But would you be of the opinion, maybe in certain cases they have been negative, but taking into consideration the vastness of this problem, of this phenomenon, antidepressants have a positive role to play. Not the only
role. I'll have a go at that because as a user, as it were, there are hundreds of thousands of people worldwide alive today because of antidepressant medication and the progress that we've made in antidepressant medication. There are problems. Antidepressants are for a serious illness called depression, and they have to be taken seriously and monitored. If you have cardiac problems, if you have kidney problems, you'd be on medication. It'll be serious medication and it needs to be monitored. As I said, there are hundreds of thousands of people worldwide who are actually alive because of them.
I agree, absolutely. And Padraig's absolutely correct there. I think the point to note is antidepressants is, I suppose, the most effective way of treating depression from a medication perspective. Now, again, it's indicated for moderate to severe depression. You know, guidelines don't indicate, especially the National Institute of Health and Clinical Guidelines, they don't recommend you use it for milder depression. And I suppose from the person, maybe where you're coming from is maybe they're being overprescribed. And I think people are feeling that people come in, they say, I'm depressed, doctor. Oh, here's a pill. And that's not ideal. And in some cases, maybe an antidepressant isn't indicated. So it's not something to do as a first port of call necessarily. And it, as I say, it is licensed for moderate to severe depression. But they are highly effective treatments. And it is, as I say, if it's the best treatment for depression, and suicidality or people who feel suicidal are most likely people who are depressed, then antidepressants the best way of preventing suicidal ideation. Now, I suppose the other factor is the controversy with antidepressants is recently there has been, you know, a mild or an association with suicidal thoughts, especially in the early stages of treatment. I suppose the risk has been shown to be minimal, and every antidepressant has a label or a black box label on it saying, look, you need to be very vigilant of anybody who starts an antidepressant. That should be done anyway. Any mental health professional, anybody who initiates an antidepressant must be acutely aware of the fact you must observe the patient in the first couple of weeks is vitally important. It also takes some time for the antidepressant to kick in, so that's when they're most vulnerable. Success rates, I suppose, it's around the 50% mark or 50% plus mark, and that's increased up to 70% upwards if it's combined with the talking therapies. And around the talking therapies, the most common talking therapy that would be used would be cognitive behavioral therapy, which would be particularly indicated in depression. All it means, cognitive behavioral therapy. We say it as CBT. In two sentences, it's the way we think, our cognitions affect the way we behave. So if we think very negatively, or we have very negative thoughts about ourselves, our life, the world in general, it's going to affect the way we behave. In other words, we tend to, as Padraig described here quite clearly, you know, we withdraw from society. If we feel we're useless, we're a failure at everything we do, and that's often what people with depression can feel, and we call those cognitive distortions. They're distorted ways of thinking. If something goes wrong, we think, gosh, I can't do anything. That's typical. I'm such a failure. And by challenging those thoughts and saying, actually, are they based on reality at all? Then, you know, you're actually helping person, first of all, become aware of their way of thinking, which is actually quite not helpful to them, and changing their behavior in some way.
Depression doesn't have to be permanent. It doesn't have to be all your life.
No, it's treatable. And that's really important to know. Talking and knowing that your GP first, as a first port of call, and, you know, there's plenty of, as St. Patrick's Hospital will talk to and see anybody who comes to their hospital.